Welcome, welcome, beloved listeners, to another week of the Little Wireless Program, and tonight, Variations on War and Peace. I'll be welcoming back Oliver Buller to the program shortly to discuss what's going on in Ukraine. Oliver is Caucasus editor for the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. Then it's Barry Hill's return to the program after about a decade, and he wants to discuss peacemongers, in particular Gandhi and Tagore. But before I introduce Oliver formally, I was bullied into becoming a tweeter by my executive producer, Gail, and I've become quite hooked on it, and I find it quite fascinating. Late last night, I was recalling that I used to ask every guest on the program, first up, what their first memory was, because I find them often revelatory. They're frequently traumatic, and often they seem to direct the person into a certain attitude to life ever after. So last night I asked people to tweet me their first memories. The result has been an inundation of experiences, absolutely astonishing. Many of them, yes, apocalyptic, but just as many, quite charming and quite poignant. So I'm just going to warn Oliver that in just a minute I'm going to ask him for his first memory before we really get stuck into Ukraine. Now, over the last couple of weeks, two elections have been held there. The first on the 26th of October was an election for a new Ukrainian parliament, which saw three pro-European parties make up the majority of members. The other was held yesterday in pro-Russian, rebel-held eastern Ukraine. The Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic elections have been condemned by the European Union, the US, and by Ukrainian authorities as being illegal and unconstitutional, but the rebels claim the elections give them legitimacy in their plans for an independent state. And Oliver will now give us some wise words on what's going on, but first, Oliver, you have been warned. What was your first memory?
Well, I'm from Wales, from a village in Wales, but my great-grandmother lived in London, and I think my first memory was staying the night at her house and being totally baffled by the fact it wasn't dark at night and lying there in bed and wondering what on earth was going on outside, why the night was orange.
Well, you see, that has made you a professional questioner ever since. That you have been directed into journalism and analysis of all sorts. Now, yesterday's elections in what Vladimir Putin is calling New Russia were by no means ordinary, were they?
No, these, to be fair, it's difficult to know what the most surreal element of the elections were. Of course, it's quite weird that there wasn't really an electoral any list of voters, particularly. It's quite weird that the polling stations were full of armed men. But to me, I think the most strange thing is that this is an election by an uprising that describes itself as being against the fascist rulers in Kiev, and yet the only people they could find to come and observe their elections were European fascists from a succession of far-right parties from across the European Union. I find that particularly telling. This is the sort of the knots that everyone has tied themselves in this year in that part of the world are pretty intractable, to be honest. I don't really know how anyone's going to get out of this.
Oliver, how will the EU and US respond to Putin's recognition, celebration of these elections and the new relationship that Russia is promising to forge?
Well, I haven't seen that Russia has formally recognise the results yet. I saw beforehand that they said the results had to be respected, but they haven't, as far as I know, yet said these are the legitimate rulers of these regions. I think if Russia does come out and say that, and if they sort of have a reception in Russia for, you know, the new, I don't know what we're going to call them, the new sort of supposedly elected people of these supposed countries, then I suspect the EU and the US and presumably their allies will have to act and will have to tighten the sanctions on Russia. And that would be very significant because the economic damage that the sanctions already existing are causing on Russia is very severe. The Russian ruble is falling further. Today it hit an all-time low. last Thursday before rallying slightly when the central bank raised rates by a point and a half. So, I mean, this is, things are really bad. Capital flight is severe. The economy is stagnating. You know, sanctions have had a major effect, but they have do not appear to have changed Putin's mind in any way. He is continuing with his course of attempting to destabilize Ukraine. And if the sanctions so far haven't done anything, it seems pretty unlikely that further sanctions will do anything else.
I hadn't heard that the sanctions had bitten so deeply.
They have, yeah. They're very cleverly designed, actually. I must say, I was fairly sceptical when they were first announced, but actually, I've sort of come around to the idea that this was rather clever. They're sort of like they're a slow release capsule of sanctions, whereby essentially they cut off financing and technology for Russia's key industries, which are arms and oil. So gradually, Russia has been sort of increasingly sort of hoping that it will have its own sort of shale gas revolution and a shale oil revolution, and in order to do that, it needs Western technology and Western help, because its own firms haven't got the technology that's been developed mainly in the United States to sort of develop these kinds of sort of more extreme oil that they haven't developed in Russia before. Now that is now cut off to them, they won't have that anymore, which means that Russian oil production is likely to start falling you know, within the next couple of years. And this makes up, energy exports make up half of Russia's budget. So they start to sort of strangle Russia in this sort of in a long-term way, which gives investors a lot of doubt that the Russian economy is much of a bet. So then money starts leaving Russia, and then the ruble starts falling, and then it all becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So no, I mean, the sanctions have been very clever, actually.
LNL or Leninl on air, online and on your tablet, mobile and via podcast, and my guest is Oliver Bullough. Now, Oliver, the new Ukrainian parliament has ended up with 1, 2, 3 pro-European parties winning a majority, and the pro-European and pro-Russian sides of Ukraine are drifting ever further apart. This does not augur well for a solution to the conflict.
No, it doesn't. I mean, but it should be said that the solution to this conflict sadly does not lie in Ukraine. The solution to this conflict lies in Moscow, really. The Crimea has obviously been separated from the rest of Ukraine. Now the Luhansk and Donetsk regions, or other parts of them, have also been effectively separated from the rest of Ukraine. You know, this has been done to a large extent by Russian citizens, and certainly with the connivance or active involvement of the Russian authorities. So it would be nice to think that after these two elections have gone, the respective leaders of their chunks of Ukraine could all get together and sit around a table and say, all right, let's move ahead and we'll agree to some form of autonomy like Catalonia or Scotland or so on. That isn't, I don't think, likely to happen, because, you know, these people are not Ukrainians. They don't have any interest in being in Ukraine. They want to be in Russia. It would have been this time last year, it would have been inconceivable that Russia would have annexed any bit of a neighboring country. But we all know that actually Russia's done that in Crimea. So I suppose it's perfectly possible. And it's always best, to be honest, to expect the worst at the moment in Ukraine. It's perfectly possible that a referendum will be organised in the next couple of months, and these bits will join Russia as well. And then once that happens, who knows what will happen, really. It's all up in the air. They're all bets are off, essentially. It's pretty difficult to predict what's going to happen.
Well, that's sounding increasingly apocalyptic. And as I said, Putin is talking about new Russia. Oliver, it was corruption that was at the centre of the revolution in Ukraine, and this in turn allowed Putin to see an opportunity of exploiting that unrest and taking back Crimea. Was dealing with corruption an important issue in the recent parliamentary elections?
It certainly was. I mean, the one of the reasons these parliamentary elections were held was because they weren't due to have another parliamentary election for a little while. One of the reasons these elections were held was because the old parliament was so astonishingly corrupt. It was sometimes referred to by its detractors as the biggest business club in Europe. And it was essentially entered parliament to a large extent in order to make money. Not everyone, but most people. This new parliament, it hopefully, will be a lot more capable of overcoming its own business interests and doing something about corruption. Because corruption has had, under the last president, reached truly, you know, epic proportions. You know, there's probably sort of 20% of GDP was being stolen every year And that is something that no country could survive. It's not really surprising in a way that Ukraine started to fall apart because so much money was being stolen that the country was just sort of on its knees. They have already taken some significant steps to combat corruption. They've changed the way the state spends money. It's now more visible what the state is spending money on and how it's spending it. They have created, as yet sort of slightly undefined, but they've created a sort of a version of the FBI, an anti-corruption agency that should have very broad powers and hopefully be independent of the government. And that's very important. And they've started to reform some of the more sort of overmighty parts of the state that were able to use their power for their own gain, particularly the state prosecutors.
I should point out to the listener, Oliver, that you're the author of a case study that examines the endemic corruption in Ukraine and using statistics from Transparency International's latest Corruption Perceptions Index. It seems that Ukraine has levels of corruption on a par with the Central African Republic, with whom it shares the 144th place on the index, alongside Nigeria and PNG.
That is pretty impressive, isn't it? It's what's weird about Ukraine is you go there and you think you're in an ordinary European country, and then if you start sort of delving beneath the surface, you do realise that this place is sort of beyond a basket case. I'm not sure what's underneath a basket case, but it is rotten to the core. And that's the thing. If you start thinking of Ukraine as being a Central African Republic rather than a Central European Republic, then you realise why it's fallen apart. This is what countries like Central Africa.
Well, it's a very useful tool, and I thank you for it. It's very difficult for anyone to operate in Ukraine without taking bribes. Can you give us a couple of case studies, one involving a doctor and one a bar owner?
Oh, well, yeah, this is a doctor who I was talking to, who essentially he runs an intensive care unit at a cancer hospital. And after, you know, being operated on, people do require, obviously, intensive care just to stay alive. They need respirators and all the other sort of high-tech machinery that hospitals use. In order to maintain this equipment, which is necessary, obviously, in order to keep people alive, he needs money. The hospital gives him no money at all to maintain the equipment he needs to keep people alive. Therefore, he has a choice, essentially. He can shut down his unit and all the people will die, or he can take bribes, effectively. He can demand money from his patients in order to keep his patients alive. So he has a choice. He can either be a good doctor and keep people alive, or he can be an honest citizen and not take bribes. He can't do both. And this is it's a very humiliating position to find yourself in. And this is quite normal.
Well, makes it ethical to take bribes because that's the greater good.
Well, this is the thing, but obviously, if everyone is in that position, and to be honest, he's a nice guy, and not everyone is a nice guy. If everyone is in that position, it's a very slippery slope from saying, "Well, I need to take bribes to do my job." Then you say, "Well, you know, I deserve to go on holiday, really. So I need to take bribes to go on holiday." And then once you deserve to go on holiday, you deserve a better car, and you deserve a better watch, and you deserve a better house, and so on and so forth. And thus, an entire system is created from the fact that the essential services are underfunded. The same goes with policemen. Policemen who are paid, they're not paid enough money to live on, therefore they have to take bribes. But then a system is created whereby law enforcement becomes corrupt, and then that is very dangerous. And this takes me on to the other example you alluded to about the bar owner. He set up a bar in the town of Slavyansk, which was one of the places that became sort of notorious earlier this year for the fighting that was happening. Yeah. And he decided, he made a conscious choice never to pay bribes. He just wouldn't pay bribes. He had inspections from the fire agency, from the tax inspectorate, from every government body. Every day they were coming down. And then, to make matters worse, this sort of effectively paralyzed his business, the policeman would come and sit in his bar from morning till night and then leave without paying the bill. Eventually, it got to the point where he just had to shut the bar. He could not function as a legal businessman. Honestly, it just wasn't possible. He could function paying bribes, but he couldn't function not paying bribes. So it's the system is created, or was created, the system they're trying to change was created to force people to be dishonest, because that was the way state employees earned their money.
Oliver, does anyone pay taxes?
Some people do. Obviously, there are taxes which are difficult to avoid. VAT, that's what we call it in the UK, the tax that's added onto purchases. Value-added tax is the is the obvious one that's most difficult to avoid because you just add it on at the till. This creates all other earning opportunities because if you're an exporter, you get the VAT that you have paid back as a company. And therefore, if you are the organization, if you are the individual who signs off on a VAT return, then you can just refuse to do that. Someone could be owed millions, tens of millions of dollars, and you can say, I'm just not going to sign this piece of paper, and you're not going to get your money back, which makes it very difficult for businesses to function. So obviously they will say, well, if we offer you 20% of that total, will you sign the piece of paper? Or 50%, will you sign the piece of paper? So essentially a signature in Ukraine, any signature, any power that a state official has is worth money. And almost all officials have been exploiting that power to make money. The general figure on corruption is given at 99%. There are honest people, but they are very few and far between.
So we're talking about a failed state.
Well, yes and no. There is one institution that does work in Ukraine and works exceptionally well, which is civil society. There are an astonishing number of organizations that have grown up to do the jobs the state is supposed to be doing and has refused to do. So in the cancer hospital to which I was referring, there is an organization which pays for physical therapy for children who've had cancer. It pays to find the medicines that the state is failing to provide, that the state is supposed to provide. And the doctors sort of have come to rely on these charities and say, well, look, I can't do anything because there isn't any money. But if you go and talk to these people, they'll do it. And it were these organizations that led the organization of the revolution of winter last year. And they come in every sort of sphere of the economy, every sphere of the state. There are these civil society organizations that have taken over. And they are, I think, one of the reasons why Ukraine's democracy is so vibrant. Some would say Ukraine's democracy is rather over-vibrant, if you ever see a punch-up in parliament. But I think this is what makes Ukraine so different to Russia. It's because Ukraine doesn't have oil. It doesn't have the money to provide services and be corrupt. Because Russia is effectively as corrupt as Ukraine. Because it's got oil, it can provide services and be corrupt. Ukraine couldn't do that. So all these organizations that grew up provided the services which the state was refusing to provide or failing to provide, and they created the democracy and the sort of civic awareness of what's happening.
Civic awareness. How are people made aware? Does social media play a major part?
Social media does to a certain extent. I mean, the internet obviously does, but the media is relatively free in Ukraine compared to Russia and compared to much of that part of the world. So TV, you can learn a lot from TV. But to be honest, people these are issues that people come across every day. Paying bribes is just completely normal. In fact, it can be once you start a conversation with a group of people, it takes a while for anecdotes and reminiscences to flow because people don't think of it as being in any way weird. It's just when you hear one anecdote from someone, then someone else says, oh, I've got a story like that, and I've got a story like that. But they don't really think of that as being something you'd be interested in because everyone knows that doctors demand money to treat children, that traffic police demand money to not give you a ticket for speeding or whatever. So it is part of the culture, and it's going to be very difficult to root out, it has to be said.
Oliver, you've said that if the West doesn't start to help Ukraine, it may not remain pro-Western for all that long. What sort of help is needed?
Well, to be honest, the most easy help and the help, well, I say most easy, that's probably not true. The most useful help would be if the West started enforcing its own laws on money laundering. All this money that's been stolen from Ukraine has, to a large extent, ended up in the West. It's ended up in top-end properties in London. It's ended up in top-end properties in Manhattan. It's ended up buying football clubs in France or wherever, skiing chalets in Switzerland and so on and so forth. This money has reached the West and become legal money in the West despite being illegal money at home. And there is a mechanism that allows that to happen. There are banks and crooked lawyers and crooked estate agents who allow this to happen, to a large extent via Eastern Europe, via Latvia, via Austria, via Cyprus particularly. To a lesser extent, some of the countries in the Far East, Singapore and Hong Kong, do this as well. That money then channels through the various tax havens, British Virgin Islands, Gibraltar and so on, before ending up in London, where once it's in London, it can go anywhere. This system has been, you know, very lucrative for the people involved in it, but incredibly damaging for Ukraine and also to the other countries of the region that, that are suffering in the same way. And people are aware that this is happening to a far greater extent than they're aware of it in the West.
I don't Oliver, think we've got to wind
it West up. Are aware quite. Okay.
That was absolutely riveting, and I thank you very much for your time. Oliver Buller, author of, author and Caucasus editor for the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. Every time he comes on the program, I am impressed. LNL, on air, online, on your mobile, via podcast, and coming up, poet and philosopher Barry Hill.